Welcome back to the weekly roundup for RCR Plus with Dewa De Boer and William McGimsey. Welcome back, William.
Thanks, Dewa. Good to be here again, as always.
And we go through the events of the last week, in particular on the show. And it's always good to have a busy week with lots of things happening. And I think a few similar threads coming through this week, which is going to be very interesting. But first, I would like to talk about the issue that we didn't talk about last week. You specifically, before we recorded last week's show, said you had no interest in talking about this. But the story has changed, or it's survived, but it's morphed a little bit into this week. And that is the school lunch story. And the story about the school lunches in New Zealand are less about the actual lunches and more about the media obsession. And Charter Daily, which is a Twitter account that does graphs mostly about New Zealand and has actually been referenced by the Beehive in official press releases. So it's a great Twitter account to follow. And Charter Daily put up a chart of the number of pieces that Radio New Zealand had done on school lunches the previous week. So not this week, but last week. And they had published 18 stories in the past 2.5 weeks, and they had done 13 audio pieces. So there were some days where they did as many as 5 different bits of media content on school lunches, and almost every single day, you know, more than one a day on average, basically. And other media outlets have done something very, very similar. So what's up with the school lunch story? Why is the media so obsessed with it?
Well, yeah, the reason I didn't want to talk about it is because I think it's relatively unimportant, right? There's lots of really important things going on in the world right now, like China's doing live fire exercises in the Tasman. We've got a great power competition building up between the US and China. We've got a war in Ukraine that, if it goes wrong, could potentially develop into World War III, and there's very contentious diplomatic stuff happening around it. The relationship between Europe and the US is breaking down. We've got Doge. I could go on and on about the really important stories, but all the New Zealand media are talking about is school lunch this and school lunch that. And I think the reason the media does this is the media likes to talk about stories that advance a particular ideological agenda. And when the news that's happening can't be used to advance that agenda in any way, they find something else to talk about. And the good thing from their point of view of talking about school lunches is it's a way of bashing the government. It's a way of bashing David Seymour. So they talk about school lunches, and they find out all this stuff about how the school lunch program's going wrong, whether it's true or not, or whether it's manufactured. And they use it to make the government and David Seymour in particular look bad. So that's why I think they're doing it. And that's part of the reason why I don't want to talk about it.
And there are obviously lots of local stories that they don't want to be talking about around, as you mentioned, David Seymour and the Treaty of Waitangi, the embedding of tikanga into and all kinds of strange cultural requirements, Maori familiarity that has to be embedded into basically every single governmental and non-governmental organization. All of these various crown entities have all of these programs. And they keep being revealed day after day, and the media is sort of like trying to fill out their schedule with stories that are not those stories, right? And that's why we have the school lunches. And
yeah, we're living, if I can just sort of butt in there, we're living through a moment where the dominant ideological paradigm is under threat. And in America, they're taking steps to overthrow it. And there's people here, like you and I think I can say that, who would like to do the same thing here. And we're trying to pressure the government to do so. And the government's sitting in there thinking, well, and there's aspects of the government, David Seymour, Winston Peters, New Zealand First and ACT, and maybe some other bits that want to go along and do some of this type of stuff as well. So there's no good way of covering this for the media, because they're defending the existing paradigm, and the existing paradigm is unpopular. So anytime they talk about it and bring attention to it, it actually hurts the paradigm.
And speaking of the media in trouble, we have had some breaking news on Thursday, at least, that It was effectively going to be a hostile takeover of NZME, which runs the Newstalk ZB and the New Zealand Herald. And there was a Canadian billionaire who purchased 9% of a stake in NZME. I believe it may have been this week or last week. It was only really discussed this week, I believe. And unfortunately, I forget his name now, and I don't have it in front of me. But
Jim Greenan, James Greenan.
James Grennan, and he is called for the entire board of NZME to resign, and he wants to be appointed to the board and several other people with him who are going to change the direction and turn it into a proper news organization. They claim to have support from a very large number of shareholders, and they may probably, or well, they will force this issue at the next shareholder meeting, and they potentially may even win it.
Yeah, well, presumably the reason that you invest in, buy, get involved in media is you want to have some sort of say in shaping the coverage. That's one possible reason. I think that's probably the reason Jim is involved here. And I mean, I don't know exactly what direction he would want to make the coverage go in. I think he's has some sort of association with Rebel Media in Canada. I could be wrong about that, but so perhaps he wants to push things in that sort of direction, which would maybe be a Trump-friendly direction. But I'm not entirely
He did
sure.
support a website in New Zealand called centrist.nz, which I haven't had very much to do with. I know they've featured some of my writing in the past. It's the only interaction that I've had with them personally. But the yeah, I guess the spin on his or him seems to be, oh, we want neutral news that's just news, presenting the news as it is. Which I've always said is a little bit of a naive way to look at it because there's always an angle, right? Some people are always coming at it with an angle. So if you tell people that you don't have an angle, well, then they wonder, okay, well, what's his angle?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the things that strike you as important, the way you cover them, the threats to your country or to your group that you perceive, people have a lot of sort of biases. It's very hard, I think. I mean, I think you can strive for something like objective reporting in the news. I don't think you can have neutral news, but I think you can have strive toward objective reporting. But it's more like a platonic ideal that you can only ever aspire towards and get there imperfectly.
Exactly. And what you can do at a bare minimum is that you can cover both sides and you can allow different people with different opinions to be heard. That's what we do on RCR and it works very, very well. But the media has completely shifted away from that, right? It's just purely one particular ideological position that has to be aired and everyone else has to be silenced. And that's probably what Jim is trying to move NZME away from.
Yeah, I mean, the media has lost a lot of credibility and trust and audience and advertising dollars in recent years, precisely because they have been perceived to be biased, particularly in COVID, the COVID years, particularly around treaty issues, particularly to do with the Public Interest Journalism Fund. Whether NZME, the Herald, and Newstalk ZB are the worst offenders, I don't think they were the worst offenders, but still, there's probably decent amount you could criticize about them.
Well, I think the reason that he's picked NZME, and I would probably pick NZME too, say if I were a billionaire and I had to take something over here in New Zealand, they are, as you said, they're not the worst offenders, which makes it the easiest place for reform. Whereas completely a 100% ideological outfit like Stuff or RNZ is impossible, of course, to reach if you're a private investor. But basically, the other privately owned media companies in New Zealand are hard left. And that means that you'd have to get rid of everyone and start again. Whereas with NZME, you've got a little bit more balance.
Yeah, I guess if you're looking to change the editorial direction a little bit, that the existing staff within Newstalk ZB and the Herald may be more open to it, possibly.
And oh, obviously, you've had other locals like Philip Crump, who has been involved with Newstalk ZB. And so there have been people who have, who there clearly has been a move within NZME to make changes. It just hasn't been very successful. And I guess we're going to find out in the very near future how this will turn out and what impact that's going to have on New Zealand.
Yeah, I mean, media is a really interesting place. It's a place that's under a lot of financial challenge, but it's an interesting place because media, a lot of power in the modern world is channeled and goes through media. He who controls the flows of information sets the agenda for what's important and what's not. And that's why I think we've got billionaires and lots of other people who are interested in media.
Now, just to bring up the school lunches one last time, Christopher Luxon has had a lot of trouble answering questions recently, and we covered it in great detail last week as well. And then this week he's gone and had other missteps as well. There was a great, I say great, a terrible case of this brought up by Bob McCroskrey from Family First, where a teacher had emailed Luxon about trans kids and being worried that all of this gender nonsense being taught to 5-year-olds at school. And she got back a response from Luxon, from his office, but with his name on it, saying that he was a complete supporter of the LGBT community and diversity, and so on it went. Which this is not a normal way to respond to someone who tells you that, hey, maybe we shouldn't be teaching 5-year-olds, 6-year-olds, all of this disgusting stuff.
That's right, but you have to remember that the previous Prime Minister, in a press conference, couldn't define what a woman was either. Now, it's not that I don't think Chris Hipkins really doesn't know what a woman is. He's under political pressure to answer that question in a certain way, and Christopher Luxon is under political pressure to answer questions pertaining to the LGBTQ plus people in a particular way as well. And so that's why he's doing these things.
And there obviously have been lots of rumors about a coup against him, about a replacement. His polling numbers look terrible. The only real break that he has had was saying, about these school lunches, maybe parents need to make a Marmite sandwich and get an apple and send the kids to school with the Marmite sandwich and the apple. And that was seen as like, oh yes, there's the great moment where Luxon has finally said something that wasn't weaseling out. Right. He gave a definitive answer to a question, and people were shocked and surprised. And you think, is this really the best that he can do? Right. Is this like the one story, as we said, the fake, basically a nonsense fake story that's completely made up to distract from everything else? That's the one story at which he can give a good answer to. And every other important story, he gives you nonsense.
Well, the fact that he picked Marmite over Vegemite is potentially incredibly divisive and discriminatory, and it may be one of the worst faux pas he's ever made.
And we will be tracking the story of how Luxon goes, with these potential risks to his prime ministership. Even just today, you had Winston Peters make a sacking of the UK High Commissioner, Phil Gough, former Labour Party leader and Auckland mayor. He didn't inform Luxon. He was asked about this, and he said, look, I know Luxon's the prime minister, because I said, don't you know who the prime minister is? He said, of course I know who the prime minister is. I'm the one who put him there. So very, very, ta you know, taking very much a standoffish stance, almost a stance of superiority to Luxon, like he's become the minor player in all of this.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it's hard to know. Is this a controlled political messaging? Are they trying to deliver some sort of message? Is Luxon's leadership really under threat? I don't know. But the Gough story is interesting, right? So, this is a diplomat who expressed a view about Donald Trump. It's a view that a lot of people who share his political opinions would share. They would have that view too. But the thing about diplomats is, your job as a diplomat is to say the diplomatic thing, is to say the right thing at the right time. It's to avoid at all costs saying the wrong thing, to avoid offending important people in different countries. So normally I'm the free speech guy, and I say, oh, if you offend people, as long as you're saying, if you, it's not so important if you offend people. You should be able to say things. You should be able to give opinions, even if they're offensive. But I think when we're talking about diplomats, there's a different set of rules that apply. For very good reason. And it isn't a good idea for someone who's representing New Zealand to be deliberately offensive to the most powerful person in the world, potentially, and
Yes, well,
offend them and get
not
offside with
true.
them. It's not in New Zealand's national interest to do that.
No, well, from the perspective of the left there, in this case the radical left that Phil Goff is a part of, being at odds with Donald Trump is seen as a good thing. Perhaps to the Europeans, being at odds with Trump is seen as a good thing. But obviously they are very minor players, as far as we're concerned, and we don't need to pander to them in particular. And when it comes to Trump, when it comes to probably Xi Jinping as well, you don't want to be offending them, especially as a diplomat, because your job is, like as you've said, your job description is to be non-offensive. Your job description isn't to tell people what you think. It's not to give your opinion. It's to make sure that the national interest of New Zealand can be served in the best way possible.
But just trying to think about this from the left's point of view, for a long time that they've been in the mainstream, right? And they're still in the mainstream, but they've held positions of power in government and everywhere. And they could have gotten away in previous years with saying things like this. I think they've gotten into the habit of thinking it's normal and acceptable to say things like this about people like Donald Trump and about people who perhaps share his views and opinions. And the idea that now that Trump is the president again and that it's not diplomatic to be saying those things, it's sort of a different environment for them. It might be taking them a little bit of time to get used to that.
Now, in addition to Phil Goff being sacked, we've also had the CEO of Air New Zealand stand down this week. And another important resignation has come from Adrian Orr, who is the governor of the Reserve Bank. It seems to be the season for getting out and running away from your problems. Adrian Orr led the Reserve Bank and basically the New Zealand economy through some very rough times. And he, I think there seems to be a situation where everybody is glad that he is gone. The decisions that he has made have been very strange. And even if you had thought that they were understandable, the end result really of his economic movements, adjusting the OCR, what he's actually done to the Reserve Bank by bloating it with, I think he's quadrupled the staff. I mean, he's added an insane number of staff. The number of staff being paid hundreds of thousands of dollars has gone through the roof. And he's focused the Reserve Bank on cultural, sort of Maori cultural issues, where he's tried to talk about how the Reserve Bank is Tāne Mahuta, the god of the forest. Is that's their responsibility because they print I guess money on paper from made out of trees. And so he's like the god of the forest. That was his brilliant idea of how to make the economy great. And is him le you know is this a shift from the cultural issues that he was bringing to the bank, or is this about the economic issues? Well, I guess it's going to be a mix of both here.
It
What do
could
you
be
see?
either or both. It's hard to tell. The funny thing about that is working in the Reserve Bank would be one of the most sort of technical, boffin-ish type jobs where these cultural issues are the least applicable. Things like Maori cultural awareness and stuff like that, it has almost no relevance to the actual analysis that people in the Reserve Bank would do, which is very dry stuff about, economic modeling and, what the interest rates are going to do, the inflation rate and measuring that sort of stuff. And so the Maori cultural stuff just has no relevance at all to that job. But the thing with Adrian Orr is he was hired to do a job, and his job really is to keep inflation within the band. And for 3 years, it was outside the band. So he failed. Now, he had tough circumstances. He had to manage the economy through COVID, and the government poured a whole bunch of money into the economy to get us through the lockdowns and stuff like that. So it was tough times for him. But in hindsight, I think everyone kind of agrees now that he kept monetary policy too loose for too long, which resulted in a higher inflation for longer than was necessary, and which had to be corrected with higher interest rates for longer than was necessary, which hurt our economy and kept our growth low. And we've had one of the worst economic performances coming out of the COVID period of any country. I think our economic performance is one of the worst in the world, actually, coming out of
At
the
least
COVID
one,
period.
at least in the OECD, sorry, OECD, we're definitely at the bottom, I think second or third from the bottom. And if you look at the interest rate swings as well, because I saw the government celebrating saying, oh, look, the interest rate has come down by the second highest of any OECD country. But that's because, of course, it went up by more than, by that amount as well compared to the other country. So as you said, just really big swings in terms of the interest rates that did a lot of damage.
So I mean, he did a, I think objectively, if you were grading him, it wouldn't be a pass mark. You would want people to do a better job than that. But he also did, you're right, all this other stuff. He employed heaps more staff in the Reserve Bank. He paid them heaps more money, and then he did all this DEI stuff. There's just no need for that sort of thing in the Reserve Bank. It's extremely weird.
Well, speaking about the weirdness of that and the need for it, or the lack of it, that is going to be, I think, the rest of this particular roundup is weekly roundup. We'll be talking about that from a host of different institutions, because we've obviously had Richard. Speaking of resignations as well, just one more to go here in this week's list. I think Richard Prebble resigned from the Waitangi Tribunal. Basically, said that the Waitangi Tribunal had turned and had been turned into a. The treaty that turned into a socialist manifesto, and that he could no longer see himself as part of the Waitangi Tribunal, and the government had to urgently reform it to bring it back to what its original intent was. And beyond that, we've had the Psychiatric Council, we've had various guidelines released by them, by the Nursing Council as well, then guidelines, internal guidelines for Internet New Zealand as well, and perhaps some other organizations that I've missed have all. Gone down this cultural route of saying our organization is and our profession is based around understanding Maori culture, Maori language. It's about diversity, equity, inclusion, the DEI as well, and blending that all together. Every single one of these organizations and these professions seems to be putting their foot down on this. Instead of easing off, you saw we have a government that said, okay, enough of this. We're going to stop with that. All of these different crown entities are doubling down.
Yeah, there is a time and a place in government for making sure you understand, appreciate, and are sympathetic towards the Maori culture, but you have to do it in the appropriate place and to the appropriate level. And the things that are being done here are not appropriate. Nurses don't need to know about the treaty. They don't need to know all the stuff about Mātauranga Māori. These are silly requirements that distract from their real job of being good nurses. And it's the same across all these other professions. The Psychological Association one, very worrying. I mean, it's going into all this LGBTQ stuff. There's a real issue that needs to be navigated in there with the way that the Psychological Association is treating like transgenderism, for example. So there's a they it's almost like the inmates are running the asylum. They've been captured by the mentally ill, the transgender people, because the transgender people have framed their mental illness as a civil rights struggle, and therefore it's discrimination if you take the view that they're simply mentally ill.
But
And so
they all need psychiatrists, right? They all have an assigned psychiatrist. This seems to be actually a sort of a common theme where people with psychological problems have become the psychiatrist, like you said, the inmates running the asylum. And so people with
yeah.
it's like saying, oh, I have a mental illness, so I have experience with mental illness, so I'm going to go and help treat people with mental illness. No, you have a mental illness. You shouldn't be doing that. It's like saying I'm drunk. I like to get drunk, so I'm going to run a bar because I know lots about alcohol. It's a completely insane way of thinking.
That's right. I mean, there's a really interesting philosophical debate in here. It would go off on a tangent, but I guess that's what I'm on here for. About the limits of liberal tolerance, right? So the liberals or whoever we want to call them, they want to push a tolerance of pe different people's choices and as far as they can. And they say that if you're imposing your values or your morality on them, that that's wrong and that should not be allowed. But even in modern liberal democracies, we simply we do actually impose our own moral choices or our own moral values on certain segments of the population. So on children, for example, everyone would agree that it's sensible that we impose our moral views on our own children. That's part of raising a child. It's part of helping them grow up to be, well, they, I mean, they're not capable of making their own decisions. So because they're not, they're not old enough, they don't have the mental ability yet, they don't have the decision-making ability, they haven't been educated enough to do it. So we, for their own good, we impose our moral framework on them. We also do this for other people as well. We do this for the mentally ill, as I've said, because they're mentally ill, they're not capable of making their own decisions in their own best interest. So we impose our own values on them, and that is legitimate. We also do this for the elderly, right? When the elderly become no longer mentally competent and able to make their own decision making, their care gets transferred over to their family members who then make their decisions for them. And also criminals, right? We take criminals' freedoms away and put them in prison and demand they do rehabilitation programs. And part of the reason we do that is to protect ourselves from the criminals. But part of the reason we do that is also to try and help the criminal stop being a criminal so he can live some sort of good life. So what I'm saying is, it is reasonable under certain situations for the majority of the population, or at least certain elements within the population, to impose their moral worldview on other people. And it's not just allowable to do that, it's actually necessary to do that in certain situations for the good of the people it's being done to.
And to actually bring these changes about, the government will require, good personnel to actually restore balance and restore order to these different departments. And this is why I'm
I've
so
taken you
sad
way
about.
off track. I've talked about something completely different, and now we're going
Yeah,
back to government
I
departments.
think this works well. I'm just going to bring it back. I did enjoy your tangent, because it is important. And as you explained. What the problem is, of course, the solution here, bringing this back on track to, bringing the institutions themselves back on track. And Richard Prebble, for instance, leaving at the Waitangi Tribunal.
You're not drawing an analogy between like a mental illness and some of the government departments, are you, dear?
That's
Because,
exactly, it's exactly what I'm
I mean,
doing.
what is a mental illness? A mental illness, take the transgender people, right? They have a belief that they're a woman when they're a man, or they're a man when they're a woman, right? That's a belief. But because that belief is so obviously and blatantly incorrect, we say that people who get that belief wrong are mentally ill. So it's a wee bit subjective where you draw the line between just being wrong about something and being mentally ill. But yes, I mean, there are people with beliefs in the government that are really wrong. And is it really that unreasonable that at a certain point, someone else imposes more correct beliefs on them?
And this is something that Elon Musk has termed the woke mind virus. I think sort of applying it in this certain sense as wokeness as a mental illness is not an uncommon thing to do. I'm not out of line here by making that comparison. But the important way to fix these institutions then is to get the right people in there to clean things up and to restore some sanity, to restore clarity to the mission of these institutions. You need the right people. But if people just leave or refuse to join, well, then you have a problem. So Richard Prebble saying, I can't be part of this Waitangi Tribunal is understandable, but at the same time, the only way that we can actually have proper reforms of the Waitangi Tribunal is if the majority of the tribunal is has the right mission in their mind. The only way you can transform the psychiatric council is if you have the right people there. And to his credit, David Seymour is supposed to be appointing people there. It seems he may have reappointed some of the existing ones who have gone rogue now, but he is actually actively taking job applications. So if you're a psychiatrist and so on, or a pharmacist, even I think the pharmacy council as well, these applications are being taken. You can actually get on there and make a difference. So they are looking for personnel. And as I've said a few weeks ago, personnel is policy. And it's the same thing with Internet NZ, which, as I said, is they should be just registering domain names, and instead they talk about how they run their Internet NZ is being run with the values of the Treaty of Waitangi. And you start to wonder, well, hey, is my domain name going to get cancelled if I don't end up aligning with them? And of course they say no, that we're not restricting free speech at the moment. But of course that can change, because if the people who are running it become more and more radical, then that's going to start influencing the decisions that are made. We've seen that in all of these bureaucracies. So what the Free Speech Union is doing, in trying to replace people on Internet New Zealand as well, getting pro-free speech people on there, and we've had the same with elections. There have been elections for the Department of Conservation recently, or so people could have, not elections, but people could put their name forward to be appointed to the Department of Conservation boards. All of this is all very, very important stuff. Like, we shouldn't trivialize this to say, oh, you can't make a difference. The reality is that if the government is going to make a difference, they need to have good people there who are going to follow through. Otherwise, the institutions will simply end up ignoring the government. And we've seen too much of that. And I've been very, very critical of government ministers for not doing enough. But there's, they when I talk to them, privately, and I say, what are you doing? They come back and say, oh, well, we need good people, and we can't just get rid of everyone, and so on. So there has to be both sides of this, where you need to have both the policy coming through the government and the right people coming up through these organizations, and then we can actually fix the mental illness, the woke mind virus that's infected all of our institutions.
That's true, but I just want to touch on Richard Preble. So, I have some sympathy from Richard Preble because I was in a similar position to him. I no longer work in the public sector. I bailed out like Richard Preble did, kind of. I mean, I was there for 15 years, but at a certain point, you have to make a rational decision about whether you can actually achieve anything in the role, whether it's possible for you to achieve anything, or whether you're better off applying your skills and your efforts elsewhere. And I think that that is what Richard Preble has done. He's decided that if he was to stay, he would be a lone voice on the Waitangi Tribunal who would be ignored, and that would be it would be ineffective for him to stay there, and so that's why I think he's made the decision that he has. So you're right, personnel is policy. We do need to get enough people in to make a difference, but there's an issue around critical mass of people. It's no good having one or two people. You have to get up to the correct number of people, a sizable enough number of people, so that you can act as an effective balance for the people with the other opinions within the organization. Otherwise, you're not going to be able to make any difference.
A fair enough point about Richard Preble. Of course, I fully understand that it's very, very difficult for someone to just be sitting there by themselves, to be ineffective. And you sort of have that in Parliament as well sometimes, where this a guy who you agree with who's sitting there, and he doesn't have anyone else to back him up, and then he doesn't get anything done. And so it's a very frustrating position to be in. And of course, it really is the fault of the government for just not giving him enough backup, right? They should have actually begun the reforms of the Waitangi Tribunal at the same time that they put him in, whereas now it just felt like they sort of hung him out to dry. So yeah, it's a difficult position, and I hope we really get some big improvements on there in the time ahead. We've got just a minute for some international issues. I think we may just quickly want to cover those, even though we have used up enough time for today. There have been some developments around Ukraine and the war in Ukraine in the last week. The Europeans basically have all come together. European leaders want to continue the war. That's their big thing. They want to continue the war, and the Americans have got to the point where they have pulled out, completely suspended the support of aid of any more supplies and weapons to the war. And there seems to be some flip-flopping from Zelensky going on about mineral rights that Trump wanted. It's unclear to me what the exact position of that is at the moment. This looks like a quite a a tough situation, one that could decay very, very quickly, because at this point the only thing that, the Europeans can't ramp up their manufacturing. So what are they going to do? Send troops and then start a, a regional war. And of course it could go the other way very quickly now as well, where the Ukrainians and Zelensky in particular say, okay, we have to come back to the table. And the war could be, a truce could be signed, right? And this is it. The war doesn't need a full treaty, it just needs a truce. Basically, we both sides stop fighting, and you freeze the conflict, and then you start negotiating. And that seems to be what Trump is aiming for. And it is just, yeah, it's hard, really, really hard for me to make a prediction about that, because those two things could happen either at one very quickly, like an escalation or an end. And it's like it's on a coin toss.
Well, what's the big picture here, though? The big picture is that the US has been a global hegemon and has been in a decline in a relative power sense relative to China. And we're entering a transitional period where China may or may not become more powerful and become a global hegemon itself and replace America. So, what does America need to do? It needs other people to contribute, it needs its allies to contribute more to defense. And so, Trump backing out of Ukraine, criticizing the Europeans, what he's effectively forcing them to do is to take more responsibility for the defense of their own continent and contribute more to their own defense spending, which is what needs to happen in order to keep the total NATO defense budget to allow it to keep up and balance against China, Russia, and this other bloc. That's developing. So I think that is part of the calculation here.
And of course, because you mentioned China in this equation, and that's often not mentioned when we talk about the Ukraine war, people don't talk about China, and that the US and Trump in particular see China as the main threat, China being our number one trading partner and the US being our number two. But in the context of Russia, for Trump, his primary focus here seems to be rehabilitate Russia and peel Russia away from China, because obviously the stronger that you have Russian and Chinese relations, the more powerful China is. So if you can actually make peace with Russia and then renormalize, rehabilitate Russia, and then you bring them back into your own sphere of influence and away from China. It seems to be, as you say, the big picture here for Trump.
Exactly right. And so NATO kind of made sense in the context of the, or at least NATO's hostility to Russia, NATO's view of Russia as the antagonist, made sense in the Cold War, where Russia was communist and the West were capitalist, and there was an ideological divide there. But Russia is no longer really communist. And so NATO's self-perception as this defense entity to counterbalance Russia, it's sort of it's hard to understand why that why Russia is necessarily a foe. I mean, they have a lot of nuclear weapons, they're a great power, but they're not intrinsically ideologically hostile in the way they were when they were communist. So the problem for having a big defense alliance like that, NATO, that excludes Russia, is that it looks like a hostile entity from the Russian perspective. It sort of creates it's sort of creating the antagonism more than solving it to a certain extent. And so, I think if it, I think I agree with you. I mean, efforts to peel Russia away and use them to help counterbalance a rising China. It may be a difficult thing to accomplish, but if it could be accomplished, that would be a potentially a worthy goal.
Well, on that, we will end the show. Thank you very much for tuning into the weekly roundup. And if you enjoyed it as well, you can text us your thoughts on 2057. You can email inbox@realitycheck.radio. And if you have any important news items or topics that you would like us to discuss during the week, just send them through, and the helpful inbox staff will make sure that it's included in my schedule. And we'll see you next time on the weekly roundup. Thank you for joining me, William.
Thanks, Dewa.